we are on to issues in paper. Three. Cheryl?
Yes. Good morning, everyone. Agenda paper three is the accounting for proceeds and cost of testing. The topic is how to account for proceeds received before PT becomes capable of operating in the manner intended by management. In the previous committee meeting, the committee tentatively decided that only proceeds related to testing should be deducted. And the committee tentatively decided to develop draft interpretation focusing on meaning of testing. And let's move on to the issue one. This issue relates to extractive industries. At the previous committee meeting, the committee tentatively decided that only proceeds related to testing should be deducted. And we have received a question for accounting for proceeds received from the activities other than testing. We understand that in extractive industry, proceeds could be received from the activities other than testing before PPE asset becomes capable of operating in the manner intended by management. On the basis of tentative decision made by the interpretations committee, that is only proceeds that relates to testing should be deducted from the PPE asset. We do not think that the draft interpretation applies to the proceeds received from the activities other than testing. We consider that if the fact pattern observed is similar to and relates to those in IFRIC 20, IFRIC 20 could be applied. On page 8, we'd like to ask three questions to the committees. Please take a look at page 8. The first question is, what comments does the Interpretations Committee have on the staff analysis on the applicability of this interpretation to the fact pattern in the extractive industry? And the second question is, does the Interpretation Committee agree that the principle described in IFRIC 20 rather than this draft interpretation should be applied to the fact patterns described? And the question three is, does the Interpretation Committee agree that it is not necessary to change the scope paragraph of IFRIC 20?
So these are the questions immediately following paragraph 19.
Exactly.
Comments? Andrew, we'll just start from there and work around.
You know, on the extractive industries, you know, as you all know, there is some industry practice of deducting proceeds from the cost of developing the mine up to a certain point of commercialization in some parts of the world. I don't think that's got anything to do with testing. I think that's an entirely different industry practice. I certainly welcome having a discussion about whether IFRIC 20 should be broadened to include underground mining as well as surface mining, but it's been very deliberately and clearly scoped only to include surface mining. So if we're actually looking to affect some kind of what would be a major change of industry practice, I think we need to be intentional about that and not kind of rely on people getting there through the IS8 hierarchy, which has been there for a long time, and that hasn't actually resulted in this change of practice. But I do think we need to have a proper discussion, because this will be a major change to a previous IFRIC interpretation.
John?
Yeah, I sort of agree with Andrew's point. I mean, I think the issue for non-testing, I think the issue in the extractives is revenues arising not from the narrow definition of testing activities. It's actually revenues, it's actually combined production and development activities giving rise to inventory and giving rise to an asset. And it's very similar to the IFRIC 20 issue in that it's cost attribution. It's cost attribution to production activities, and it's cost attribution to the construction of an asset. And I agree that IFRIC 20 would be on point in terms of its analogy, but I also agree with Andrew's point. I don't think people will, I don't think relying upon the IS8 hierarchy that people will then say, well, IFRIC 20 has to be applied, is going to be effective. And I think there are probably other issues. You know, IFRIC 20 took a lot of debate, and there was a lot of discussion about the nature of surface mining, what's a component of an ore body, etc. I think if you actually try to extend it to the broader extractive industries, I think there will be a lot of other issues that would also have to be debated and discussed as part of that. So, I mean, I personally would be in favour of a project to look at cost attribution, because I think the real issue in extractives is the combined, one activity giving rise to inventory and giving rise to an asset, and it's all about cost attribution. So I would be in favour of taking on a project, but I think it's a bigger project and we'd need to pay more attention to the issues involved in that in it. So
your proposal would be to do what to the interpretation, just for clarity?
Well, I think it would be to scope out the revenues from non-testing activities and to look at a broader project on cost attribution, where you're actually constructing an asset and producing inventories at the same time.
Okay. Reinhardt?
My comments are I'm sorry. Too quick on the draw, or too slow, whatever. My comments are very similar. I think this would be a major change to what practice is, and I think practice is largely because the wording in IS 16, paragraph 17E, is not clear in that respect, because it basically says that you can deduct the proceeds from selling any items produced while bringing the asset to the location and condition. Example of testing is given as an example. And so I think the thinking is that those activities that are part and parcel of making or getting that asset, the mine, in operation, any proceeds that come about as a result of that will be deducted from the cost of the asset. So I think if we proceed down this route, I would agree with what John said, that we would need to scope out those types of proceeds and cost attribution, because that will be a major issue. But I think as well, the question I have is whether we would need to propose a change to IS 16, paragraph 17E, to clarify, because right now it's broader, or could be read to be broader than simply saying that only the proceeds from testing can be deducted against the asset, because it specifically says it's the proceeds from bringing the asset to that location and condition that would be deducted.
Martin?
Yeah, I'm a little bit confused about extractive industries. I mean, the overall interpretation later on shall not deal specifically with an industry issue. So it is not only related to extractive industries or so. It should be a general interpretation. So either one looks much deeper into the business models of the extractives, or we find something which could be applied for each and everyone. I believe there are more industries dealing with testing costs. For example, the chemical industry. If you set up a new chemical plant, for sure you have to test it. The question is whether the output you could sell at a reasonable price or so. Yes, okay, but it might not only be the extractives. For sure, probably the biggest materiality is within extractive industries. However, as this is a general interpretation, we should not only have the extractives in focus.
Or alternatively, we could scope out extractives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll scope it in.
Tony?
Yeah, very similar remarks to John and Reinhardt. And I have an overall concern that the scope of what we're doing, starting with a very narrow question about what do you do with proceeds in excess of costs, and we've now expanded it to proceeds from stuff other than testing, we've expanded it to functioning properly, we're perilously close to telling management when an asset is capable of operating in the manner it intended. I think it's just got bigger and bigger and bigger. I think IFRIC 20 was scoped after the result of many agonizing hours around this table, and I would be very reluctant to go revisiting that scope. So my sense is we should not address at all proceeds other than from testing, and we should focus on the question that we were asked.
Okay, I see heads nodding yes. The implication would be, let me ask it in two pieces. Piece one would be to say, Chair will correct me if I've got this wrong.
Right.
This is an interpretation about testing, period. Other stuff, we're not going to talk about. Step one.
Right.
Having done that, do we then also need an explicit carve-out for extractive industries on the basis that there's all kinds of issues in extractives that the board will have to deal with someday, but not right now? Philippe?
If the scope is specifically testing, is there any specific in the mining extractive industries about testing which might need to be scoped out, or is it implicit by a good definition of testing that other matters which are not testing are out of the scope?
That was going to be my question. Is one sufficient, or do we need to do both? You're saying one is sufficient. Michael?
Can I just say, if our focus is to interpret, to explain, to clarify paragraph 17E, just think about what Reinhardt was saying earlier about the broader interpretation that many mining companies have taken in reading 17E. I don't know that we can clarify 17E on a narrow basis without affecting the broader interpretation or the broader reading that mining companies take currently of 17E.
Could we just then answer the question we've been asked?
Which is, what do you do with proceeds in excess of costs instead of expanding it beyond that? Because that's where we started. If we just answered that question, which we do, we say proceeds in excess of cost get deducted from the cost of the asset. If we just limited it to that and didn't do the rest of it, then I think we'd be fine. The problem is that we've gone way beyond that into functioning properly and when something is capable of operating in the manner intended. If we just focus on the question we had, I don't think we'd need to worry about scoping it.
But if we did exactly what you suggest, how do you deal with the question when you stop?
We weren't asked that question, and people are dealing with it comfortably at the moment without too much trouble.
I thought that the original submission actually focused on the situation in which a company had been deducting costs for what seemed to the locals an extensively long period, several years. And they wanted their question, I thought, the essence of their question was, how do we get them to stop? Have I got it wrong, Charlotte?
On when you stopped putting the costs in or when you stopped deducting the proceeds. I thought it was on the deducting the proceeds. I agree you have to define testing, but I don't think we've been asked a question on what you do with proceeds in any of the other situations in paragraph 17. I haven't seen that there's diversity in practice or any of the issues. So I think that would be opening a whole new can of worms.
The question about those other proceeds came out of the outreach that we did in response to this submission.
It was clear from the outreach that there were a whole raft of other issues and diversity in practice. That's where the issues about the treatment of other proceeds came up and the diverse treatment. And also, I don't agree with Tony that there's not an issue and that there's no diversity. It's not the question we were asked, but there's a whole raft of issues related to that particular space, and there's enormous diversity in practice in the accounting.
Andrew?
There's diversity in practice, but I don't think the diversity relates to what people understand by testing, which doesn't strike me as the kind of word we need to spend a lot of time defining in a principle-based system. But I do think there's is a bit of a challenge of defining a project in terms of proceeds in excess of the cost of testing, because it begs the question what you do when your cost of testing is zero. In other words, you're not actually testing. It seems that we're going to have to pick our words extremely carefully to clarify a very narrowly pinpointed question.
Bonnie?
I was just going to echo what John said, that I thought we opened the question up broader because we saw that there was diversity in practice as to what's meant by capable of operating in the manner intended by management, and I thought that's why we included that as part of the guidance that we were proposing to issue, which if there is diversity, it seems as though we should address it if we can according to to our guidelines.
Jungwoo?
Thank you. This is a very quite difficult project, getting worse and worse. Koichiro is on the really working hard, but this looks like a very comprehensive project on IAS 16. So as Tony suggested, I think we need a kind of two-tier approach. First approach, just to answer the question simply, rather than defining, describing what the testing means and everything. You suggest to us a very good idea, just the conversion with the ESCAP, then we don't need any description of testing because everything is clear. Maybe investors would like to have such kind of information rather than just keep them, you know, on the amount of asset. So, you know, this is a really quite important issue. So I strongly recommend, you know, separate these two issues, two approaches. One fundamental issue, just toss to the board, you know, just to get a good improvement of the IS 16 or IS 2 and everything related to it. So it's not easy to define every important concept here in this in our small project that I'm suggesting.
Sue and then Bruce.
And mine was partly a question to the staff, but my recollection from the board's discussions was that there was a sense that the board thought that the circumstances in which these net proceeds should be offset against the costs of something, as opposed to being recognised as revenue in the financial statements, should be relatively limited. And there was a general concern about how broadly this 17E might be being applied in practice, which was why some board members went so far as to suggest, why don't we just do what the US does and just says no. The board overall disagreed with that blunt approach, but I think sort of in response to Tony's comment, while I certainly read these papers and think Jesus seems to be getting big, I think the board's direction was really to try and make sure that everybody's clear that this is really a narrow thing, and to make sure that it's read the way that the board seemed to think that it should be read, which would be broader than just the question that Tony had suggested. Is that a fair recollection?
I was going to say, the narrow thing in your construction is the number of situations in which the entry is credit asset.
Exactly. Because generally we wouldn't think that would be something we'd expect to see. We think it's more useful that the revenue is going to profit or loss, and we're surprised that there might be these very extended circumstances in which people think it's correct to continue to make this adjustment against the carrying amount of the asset, even if that's what people are doing. Is that accurate?
Yeah, exactly. So the concerns we heard is that the wide range of use of this paragraph can distort the usefulness of income statement. Revenue information should not be deducted from the asset. That's the concern we've heard. And also the Tony's comment. So the clarification we are making here is that even though proceeds exceed cost, we allow deduction of these proceeds from the asset. And that's the opposite direction. So that's why we think that in addition to clarify that original point, we want to have some kind of anchor to narrow the deduction of proceeds. So that's the whole direction, the whole point.
Not even to narrow, to make sure that it's understood in the way that the board thought that the words that already exist were intended.
Bruce?
Thanks. I was just going to make a comment. I was quite comfortable with the scoping and where we were going. I accept that it's broader than the question was asked, but I think that, you know, it's one of those difficult things that we opened that can of worms, and when we realized it, I think it's very difficult for me not just to draw out one and say I'm only going to deal with that issue. I think these are very, very related. I'm glad that the comments you made, because, I mean, that was my question. I mean, if we, you know, what does the board think? Do they think it's clear? If the answer is no, and the board is saying, well, we don't like the US alternative, which would be our easy answer, just to adopt that and go, well, then I think we kind of left having to answer it. I just don't see how we can then take a decision and say, the board aren't comfortable with the way that the wording is put in there. We, you know, they don't like the idea of the US approach, but nobody's going to address it. I think we've got to do it. So I was going to say, I was very supportive of it. I do accept it's a lot further than where we'd gone, but I just think in this situation, it's unique that we have to address it, because they're just too interrelated to ignore the one or the other.
Tony, you're jumping to get in.
Yeah, I understand what Sue had to say, and I think I also take John's point that there is a bigger issue here, and there probably is some diversity in practice around when folks stop capitalizing, when they stop deducting proceeds from the cost of the asset. There probably is some diversity. My concern, I think, in response to those remarks, is this is then neither one thing nor the other. We're not answering the question we were asked, which the paper tells me is about excess proceeds. That's the one we were asked. Nor does it address the broader question that Sue just posed, and I think John posed earlier. We're doing neither one thing nor the other. If collectively, and I think what Brian Art and Bruce and John and Sue have said, is there is a bigger issue about 17E, then perhaps we should try and address that. I just think this falls between the two stools and gives us half an answer.
John?
Yeah, just to come back on what Sue said, I mean, I think the reason that people tend to take a broader view of the application of 17E and crediting the proceeds to the cost of the asset is actually the difficulties in cost attribution. Because if you actually stop crediting the proceeds to the cost of the asset, you then have to determine what cost should be attached to inventory because you're generating revenue versus what cost should be capitalized. So the difficulty, to me, this whole issue of the treatment and interpretation of 17E stems from the difficulty of cost attribution in something like the extractive industries, which is why people tend to take, well, it's all going to be accounted against the asset until I reach a certain point. The problem is, in practice, that point, there's massive diversity over what point that is. And I've seen some things at this end of the spectrum where people are crediting proceeds until there's almost no asset left, versus people who actually start very early recognizing revenue and treating it as production. So I think there's huge diversity in that. And I think this issue goes back to what capable of operating in a manner intended by management means, but also cost attribution between activities which give rise to production and activities that are asset construction.
Andrew, then Michael.
And we're talking about a possible interpretation. I'd actually agree with Reinhardt that 17E can be read to address just proceeds during testing activities, or read to address proceeds more broadly. We're using testing as an example. But we also need to, focusing on 17E, look at paragraph 21 that talks about incidental operations, and seems to me to suggest that there might be other proceeds you deduct if those operations are not incidental and are necessary to bring the asset to the location and condition intended by management, etc. So I'm not sure we can, I don't necessarily buy into the objective of trying to kind of limit the deduction of proceeds to testing, but that is the objective. I don't think an interpretation's the right tool to get us there. I think we need to change IS 16.
Michael?
I was just thinking about what John was saying about the cost attribution issue, and I do see that as being a key element of this, given what we've heard about diversity in practice in various industries. I think it's fair to say that the draft interpretation is written principally in terms of focusing on 17E, and perhaps if we wanted to address the cost attribution issue more directly, then it would require an additional element, whether that's through the interpretation or whether it's through some amendment, as Andrew was saying. Obviously, we could look at what mechanism we might use for that. But perhaps there is an argument to say, well, you know, if this cost attribution is a significant issue, which I think I would tend to agree with that, John. It is, then we ought to make that a key part of the focus of the work that we do.
Okay, we have reached the point that I have seen in every standard setting exercise I've ever participated in, at which everybody sits around and says, whose idea was this? Who thought this was a good idea? Yeah, well, we all did, all of us all. Before sending the staff off to wander again in the wilderness, I'd like to see if we can develop a steer here. Let me introduce it with a couple of observations. Going back and reading paragraph 17, the first word in the sentence is examples. And typically, when we're applying a standard and we have a list like that, we say it's not all-inclusive. There are examples, not all of the examples. So that would suggest that attempting to hang our hats on limiting 17E would be very difficult. And would also suggest potentially saying, well, this was a great idea, but it didn't work out. So that's alternative one, is just to say, well, this baby's ugly, give it back, we don't want it. Plan B is to circle back and what I would call the John approach and try and think our way through attributable cost or cost attribution more broadly. Not typically an interpretations committee exercise, but we can give it a try. That would be plan B. Plan C would be to take one more pass through the interpretation. So, first preference. If you lose on first preference, you get to vote again on second preference. Plan A, drop it. Quit while we're ahead. Five. Okay. What did I say was plan B?
Plan B is
the John approach.
The cost attribution.
Come back, set aside the interpretation for the moment, and come back to the committee with a broader discussion of cost attribution in the context of IAS 16. Now, since you lost on your first preference, you get to have the second first preference. How many would favor that approach?
Four, five.
Plan C.
Take another look at the interpretation.
Take another crack at the interpretation. How many would favor plan C?
One, two, three, four.
How many would object to plan C? Okay, that's what we'll do. We'll staff send the staff back one more crack at the interpretation for next meeting. You can do that. And if we can't get it done, then I'm going to bring Plan A back to you again. That was going to be my next question. What would you want them to do, having sent them off into the wilderness? Bonnie?
I mean, I think we need to answer the question. I think that we also need to perhaps reiterate the narrowness of the scope of 7E. I guess those would be the two things that I think we need to address.
Okay. Bob?
I'm wondering whether the issue isn't so much with 17E, but it's really with paragraph 20. And what do we mean by, you know, capitalizing costs up until the point where it's operating as intended by management? Mm. Whenever we get into these intention questions is where we always, well, my practice gets bogged down. So I would focus, I think, a little bit more on the interpretation around paragraph 20.
I think that's a valid point.
The other thing that I think
it's kind of going a bit broader than perhaps what we wanted to, but I think to take John's point, if we're going to say you've got to put the credit in the income statement for a class of these sales, we're going to have to tell people what debit to put in there, which kind of drifts us into the cost attribution model. Yep. So if we're going to say, oh, okay, all of these costs, all of these revenues have to go through the P&L, but it's still not capable of operating, so there won't be any depreciation or depletion. What are the costs? And I'd be happy to have another pass because that's where the committee's got to, but I don't see we can answer the what do you do with the credit question unless we answer what do you do with the debit. Because otherwise we're going to leave people hanging around what they do with the debit.
Bob, if you know, if you don't find, what is the U.S. GAAP answer to that?
To
what you, where's the debt? The U.S. GAAP answer is you never credit the asset for proceeds. What do you do with the debit? Or what? How do you derive the debit that would usually be cost of goods sold? I put you on the spot.
The raw materials, the stuff that wasn't part of the PP&E, yeah. I think practice is mixed. I'm doing from recollection. I thought we threw that into, there was a net number in the P&L. So you put the credit and the debit, the revenue and the cost together into another income item.
The question is, what is the debit? So if I'm doing work that is necessary to construct the asset, to dig the hole for the mine, and that produces something that I'm going to sell, is the debit allocated or is the debit part of the cost? And that, I think, is the fundamental question that John keeps coming back to. And I just wonder how we can address the credit question if we don't address the debit question. Unless we just tell people to put the credit in the income statement with no cost attached. To answer the question, I guess.
John?
No, I was just going to say, I mean, that was the IFRIC 20 issue, but IFRIC 20 just dealt with it in the production phase of surface mine rather than more broadly.
Yeah.
Me is that we're trying to make this decision without the information of what people actually do. Like, so investors just want to see what's the debit and what's the credit, and look across companies to see what people actually did, and we don't have that information. We don't have that information to sit here and make the decision because it's not disclosed, and we know that people take different interpretations of it, but users don't have that. And you know, honestly, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant. If people think that people are over crediting the asset, the minute people see it and compare it to other companies, people are going to change their behavior. So part of it is that I think we have a difficulty making a decision because we don't see what those numbers are, how far people have gone, or what costs are actually there. We're sort of hypothesizing. So, I mean, for me, I just look at it and say, you know, I don't know that we're ever going to come to a perfect decision, but some information about what these debits are and what these credits actually are would certainly be useful to users and to us. So is some degree of additional disclosure necessary?
Isn't there an additional concern here, because we're talking about the net cost that ends up being included in PP&E, and so it's not just during the construction phase, it's then the depreciation of the asset afterwards. This could happen for sort of 10, 15, 20 years.
Right, but if you know what people did up front, and you know that this person's overly aggressive and that person's not, I mean, the reality of it is the depreciation is a non-cash amortization of what you already, the cash that already went out the door, right? So if I know somebody's aggressive, I'm just going to adjust to make somebody more comparable with somebody who isn't as aggressive, right? But the reality of it is that I can't see now whether someone's aggressive or not. All I can see is their amortization, right? So I don't know how we know. We don't have any empirical information. We just have hypotheticals about what people are doing, both to decide for the standard and as users of the financial statements. Personally, I just think that makes it challenging to make a decision, and the reality of it is that you know, if people think people are, you know, users develop impressions of management from this information, and that information will help build an impression, and people will adjust for it. And we just don't have the information, so we're still, even in mixing this up and trying to decide the words and we're not giving users or ourselves the information that's necessary to make that decision about management.
Point taken. I'm not sure where it takes us with what the staff's assignment is, though.
I just think that, you know, some disclosure would be helpful. I guess okay. I'm not certain we solved the accounting answer, but disclosure might help solve it.
My fear in giving the staff instruction is that ultimately we have to agree on paragraph 7A and what 7A and 7B mean. And I'm a fear that IAS 16 doesn't help us very much. 7A and 7B of the proposed interpretation. Specifically, functioning properly and manner intended. Okay, I think the staff has sufficient guidance. In the words of Don Kerr. Yeah, Don.
I'm not sure it will help, but when we discussed this draft, we were wondering how will this work when you do not produce inventories. For example, when you have a power plant and in the testing phase you deliver electricity or something like that. We do not believe that it is included now. But the question is, of course, the same in both cases.
Mm-hmm. Exactly the same issue.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to give this one more shot. And if it doesn't work, then we're going to have to go back and think about Plan A again. Okay.
I just missed the other way. We have like other issues. We talked about issue one.
Do you really want to? We're going to have to come back again. Do you want to rehash through all of those? Okay. Kachiro is a glutton for punishment and reminds me that we have other issues in the paper. And I'm just asking Kachiro and Michael, given the decision we just reached, do we need to go through those other issues?
Issue two is the timing issue.
That's exactly the point I was raising. I think does anyone have on the remainder of the paper points that they would like to articulate to the staff? I do not propose to work through the remainder of the paper, given that it's all going to have to come back again. But are there specific points that you would like the staff to take into account? Sue?
When I read it, particularly given some of the discussions we'd had in the past about the relevance of the volume of production to whether or not things were operating the way that management intended or whatever the words are. And also if I look at the IS2 and what ordinary course of business means to me, I was wondering if we had a little bit too much emphasis on volumes of production for me when I read the document, and I wasn't so sure whether that would be something front of mind for me if I decided whether something was in my ordinary course of business. That was just a observation.
Okay. Other observations for the staff on the balance of the paper? I know it's unusual, but given that this has to come back again, it's probably previous to deal with some of these other questions. Reinhardt?
Just
Just, I guess, two comments, and I've shared those with the staff. I think the whole issue of functioning properly is one where there's a significant amount of judgment that will be required, and so it's important to frame some of the criteria or conditions that are evident as to functioning properly. And along the lines of what Sue was saying in terms of focusing on quantity, I was troubled by that. And I would suggest focusing more on whether you're producing your intended output, your intended product, on a regular basis, even if it's not at the capacity level that management had originally intended. So that's one comment. And then the second one, I think it'd be very important for the staff, if we proceed down this direction of limiting the credit to certain types of activities like testing, that we will need to, besides looking at costs, we will need to look at paragraph 21. Because the rest would be incidental operations. And so I think that tension will have to be addressed in the paper, in the interpretation.
John?
I mean, despite the issues, I mean, we tend to get caught in a discussion about the application of this to the extractives. I actually thought that the proposals were actually added some very good clarity to the whole notion of functioning properly and capable of operating as intended by management. Especially that it's got nothing to do with reaching your intended sort of design capacity or theoretical capacity, which I think would actually be very helpful. So maybe one of the things, if we really struggle with this application in the extractives, is actually to consider whether this is a useful interpretation scoping out extractives. And I know we don't like industry specific things, but it seemed to me there's some very, very useful guidance and very useful interpretation here of IAS 16 and the meaning of those terms. I think the concern is obviously in its application to a particular industry. So.
Gary?
Yeah, just sort of building on where Reinhardt and Sue were, I think I wouldn't focus much on volumes, because function operating as intended might very well focus three shifts going 24/7. You might only get to two shifts, and you start getting products that might take several years of marketplace presence to build up to the demand case that you're forecasting in the business plan. You may never hit the business plan. Doesn't mean you don't have a viable product. So I think Reinhardt sort of hit it as, hey, you're producing the product you intended to produce. And yes, maybe you come up 70% short of the wish list, when the business case was sold years earlier, but you're still producing a viable product. In it. So I would focus more on you're producing something that you intended to produce, and whether or not that's your intention, to produce that few, I don't think is all that relevant.
Andrew and then Martin.
I mean, looking at this, my suggestion would be to, if we're going to focus on testing within the context of the use of that word in 17E, if that's the focus, we should just limit ourselves. The draft consensus has paragraph 10 that talks about the objective of testing. And I think that's all we need to say, or all we can usefully say. I think then trying to get into what is functioning properly and what is manner intended by management is firstly just going to shift the judgment rather than eliminate the diversity. It's just going to move the diversity somewhere else, and is also just enormous mission creep. So I'll pair it right back to pretty much paragraph 10.
Martin and then Yongsu.
Similar issue. I mean, functioning properly, does it mean, is it the same point in time as capable of operating as intended by the management? Probably not. And specifically, if you have multiple elements or if you have components, it might be that one component is functioning properly and you have also tested, but overall, it is not in a way operating as intended by the management. So what happens in between?
Sue?
I just have two points. When I looked at the agenda paper 3, the paragraph from 35 to 38, the staff presented one example, which I think is very confusing. Also, something people need to know, because it says more about the difference between timing of inventory and timing of some asset being, being a PP&E, which starts the depreciation. So. My first suggestion is to include some example about this in this paragraph into the interpretation so that people can understand some special situations like it. The second one is about the agenda, the interpretation, paragraph 11. At the end of paragraph 11, it remarks about the quantity level. Quantity level which enables the entity to sell those items in the ordinary course of business. I believe that this phrase is instructed because it means inventory. Because it doesn't say it's an inventory, it's very confusing when I just read it. I just sometimes think that whether this is the quantity level different from inventory or some other things, the same thing as inventory. When I read the IAS 2, I just realized that this is the same definition as inventory. But if you don't remember IAS 2, you might think this is referring to a different quantity level. So what I'm suggesting is to say specifically this is the quantity level that remarks inventory, or just delete it so that people understand what inventory means by the quantity level. Okay.
Bruce, last call.
So just the one comment I realized I'd make was let's not be scared to tell people this is a judgment issue as well. And I think that, to me, that we have a whole rack of disclosures around key judgments and uncertainties. There's a lot of these areas where I just got a little bit concerned looking through, and we are starting to try and give people quite defined parameters and not allowing management to make those judgments. So just not to be scared to say that.
Carl is signaling me this is just a little point.
Yes, just wondering if we really have diversity in practice, or we have different facts and circumstances amongst different industries. Just wondering if it's really diversity in practice or different facts and circumstances.
Yes, we did some outreach before previously, and I put on the, just a moment please, page 7, I put the reference to the previous discussions, and we've talked with various people in various industries, and we know this, the diversity in practice exists, particularly for the extractive industry. And of course, it's different, depends on the industry. The level of diversity is different, but that's the diversity in practice we heard.
On the same circumstances.
You mean the same circumstances means?
Diversity under the same circumstances.
Yes, exactly, right.
All right, let's wrap this up. We will see you next time. This guy is always cheerful. I don't know.